We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 7, The Puff's Perspective. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Lauren Camacci and Dr. Melissa Aaron about the off-Broadway play, Puffs. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, professor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we're going to be talking about the off-Broadway play, Puffs, which is a kind of retelling of the entire 7-book Harry Potter series in 1 2-hour play. And it reminds me a little bit of, I don't know, Emily, if you've seen the reduced Shakespeare Company's production of the complete works of William Shakespeare.
I think I have.
It has a hectic vibe. It's very, you know, farcical, funny. But obviously the unity of the Harry Potter story allows for something different. And I think they're able to, you know, have kind of depth in this play.
Definitely.
That's really fascinating. So this is a kind of, I would say, like a fan work in a way, right? Mm-hmm. A fan reconception.
Yeah, it's definitely a fan work.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you're looking for, you know, some kind of creative fan take on Potter, Emily, what kind of thing do you tend to gravitate to?
So I really loved Puffs. I have to say, you know, I'd heard about it a lot. And when I finally watched it, I was like, yep, this is definitely worth all the hype and then some probably. But I will say another one that I have loved that comes to mind. There have been several, but one comes to mind, which is the Dark Lord Funk video. I'm going to be honest. I hadn't even heard this is how I learn about like pop music. Cause like, I don't know, I listen to old Thelonious Monk records, you know, I mean, like, I'm not hip with the kids, right? So like, this is how sometimes I hear about really good pop songs is through the parodies that other people share with me on social media or whatnot, because they know I love Harry Potter and Star Wars. And so, but when I saw the Dark Lord Funk, I was like, that is awesome. And I didn't even know it was like a real song. And then I found the real song and I was like doubly delighted. So Dark Lord Funk. I just shared it with my son the other day. He really liked it as well.
That's funny. I thought you were going to say like, you know, the Potter Pals or
Oh, Potter
like
Puppet Pals. Yeah, those are Potter solid. Those are definitely solid. Yeah. Maybe a little younger audience, but yeah. Definitely.
There's such creativity. Yeah. And I'm never disappointed, really. I love all of the things, you know, from the more amateurish, you know, to the quite professional. And our special guests for our episode today are going to help us to sort through the fanish fog of Puffs to analyze how this play reinterprets, challenges, reinforces key elements of the Harry Potter series. And of course, why do we like it so much? Because I'm with you, Emily. I really loved it. So first, let me introduce Dr. Lauren Camacci. She holds a PhD from Penn State and now works in the private sector in Cleveland, Ohio, and she is a member of the core leadership of Harry Potter Studies. Welcome to the show, Lauren.
Hello. Super, super glad to be here. It's a nice break from reality.
Yes, and I think, Lauren, you were the one who sort of sent out something about, you know, Puffs is on Amazon Prime, and yeah. And I was like, oh, I'm watching it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was how I got to, yeah, that was how I got to see it. That was how we got to share it when we first saw it at the Southwest Popular and American Culture Association conference in lieu of doing our normal draw it out of the hat, watch one of the 8 Harry Potter movies. And I'll let you introduce Melissa so that we could reminisce about how magical that moment was at Swapaka.
Okay, great. Well, also joining our discussion today is Dr. Melissa Aaron, professor at Cal Poly in the Department of English and Modern Languages and author of Global Economics, A History of the Theater Business, The Chamberlain's Kingsmen and Their Plays, 1599 to 1642. Thanks for joining us, Melissa.
Well, hi. I'm always happy to join you. And it's so exciting.
Yeah. And you had... you, as Lauren was saying, you watched it at Swapaka with the group at this conference in yes. Albuquerque, but you've also seen the play in person.
Yes, twice off Broadway, and I feel really lucky. I think I saw it, I'd seen it before, and then I saw it the week that they closed. It was also the very last, or at least for now, the last MistyCon, which I was the academic programming coordinator for. So there were a lot of goodbyes that week. We, you know, who knows with MistyCon, but definitely it was one of the very last productions or performances of Puffs. John Rosenthal, who is the head honcho of the group that must not be named, sort of organized that. So yeah, there was a certain tone, a certain feeling to that final performance that I was at. So,
oh yeah, I bet. And you were also one of the people who felt like the play ought to be filmed so that people like Lauren, Emily, and I could enjoy it, even if we couldn't see a live performance.
Yeah, I contributed a tiny amount.
Right.
For the credits.
Yeah. So there was a Kickstarter campaign, right? So
yes.
Yeah. Well, we are grateful. And, you know, I think one of the things that we might just talk about right here at first, and especially because Melissa, you're a theater historian, really, and you are very keen on live theater. What do you think is sort of what should we be aware of in terms of the differences between what we see on Puffs as we're watching it on Amazon Prime or whatever, compared to the live performances that you saw?
A play is not the same as a novel in the sense that I would argue that a play is not just the text. A play is sort of the text is sort of a skeleton. And the play involves things like time and space and actors and an audience and the venue. And so that means that the play is different every time it's performed. There's a lot of cool things you can say about that. But in the case of Puffs specifically, it's a small theater and it's all decorated in sort of vaguely Harry Potter, you know, sort of decorations. So you feel sort of as though you're part of school and you also hear the school announcements, you're sitting there, you really become part of the full experience. And it's a fairly small theater. I didn't see it on Off-Broadway where it was really tiny and it must have been very intimate. But even Off-Broadway, you have this feeling of being, you know, close to being in their laps. You're really close there. So that's a very different experience from watching it at the remove of seeing it on screen. Not that it's not worth it. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to make it available to everybody if it wasn't worth it. Everybody doesn't have the privilege of being in New York or wherever it's being performed, but it does have that extra element of sitting there in this very Hogwarts-y space.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's I would say probably one of the draws that that live theater would have is you're getting the chance to kind of feel like you're there. And it's kind of a fun, I bet the vibe is just a really fun fan vibe for the whole thing. It was filmed before an audience. So you do like, you get to hear the audience, you know, and imagine yourself in the audience, but it is different to watch that on the screen, I'm sure. So let's talk a little bit about Puffs as it is. We'll give it a little analysis here as a piece of, you know, fan work, fan creation. Puffs tells the Harry Potter story compressed and from the perspective of the Hufflepuffs, particularly a kid named Wayne and his friends Megan and Oliver, a little trio there. Mm-hmm. How would you all characterize this play? Is it a parody or a satire, or is it something else?
So it took me a few minutes of Googling while I was sitting there watching it. I was like, because it's not just one genre. The best I was able to come up with was that it's a pastiche of fan fiction, satire, and camp. That was sort of my assessment, because it's definitely multiple genres. And the thing that's so good about it is that it is so clever. And, you know, that's to me what makes it fanfic. But the digs at the canon and at the film canon are mm-hmm. are what make it satire, and the ridiculousness, I think, the use of appealing irony is what makes it camp.
That's neat. I hadn't really thought about camp, but I can totally see what you're saying there.
How appropriate that it's so many different genres when we just spoke to Tyson Pugh in a previous episode right. and learned about the many, many genres of Harry Potter itself. So how appropriate.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I was also, I have to admit, I went ahead and I looked at what the playwright had to say about this.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. He said that even though it is a parody, they never talk about it as a parody. They talk about it as a comedy, which sort of makes sense to me. And he also referred to it as being a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, like, look at the play. And if you're not familiar with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, it's told from the point of view of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in Hamlet, which makes total sense. Tom Stoppard really knows Elizabethan theater, and the way they used to perform is you didn't get the full script. You only got your lines and a cue word. And therefore, if you are Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, all you know is your own lines and where your spot is in the play. And you don't really know much about what happened before. So Rosencrantz and Guildenstern start in saying that they know that they were overwrought on the way by some players, and that they were summoned, but they have no memory of their lives before that. And so everything that happens in Hamlet is not very clear to them. So they're in a state of utter confusion. And it makes sense that Puffs is also from the point of view of being offstage, of having the, quote, real Harry Potter be at a distance. And instead, the Puffs you get to see the backstage view. And that's, I thought that was an interesting comparison. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's a fabulous play. I don't recommend the movie, but the play is really great.
Melissa, that's like that fantastic line from near the end. You know, it's easy to feel like a secondary character in someone else's story.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's a very aware of its Rosencrantz and Guildensterniness.
Yeah, I think that's really a key part mm-hmm. of Puffs.
And I think it's interesting you say that, you know, they don't have a real knowledge of, like, the play that they're in or where they came from before, because that's kind of Wayne's experience when he gets an owl who drops a letter and what's this about? And then all of a sudden he's a wizard, right? And he has that. And he, you know, they talk about, you know who, and they're like, we don't know who that is, right? So, so he has that sort of being dropped into that world, you know, feeling. And I was thinking also about Henry Jenkins' concept of refocalization in fan fiction. And I don't know, Lauren, you might know some more about this than I do, but the idea is that a lot of fans like to take more marginal side characters and kind of imagine what the story would be like from their perspective. And, you know, who's more marginalized among the houses than the Hufflepuffs? And so to sort of see mm-hmm. the story from their point of view, it changes the focus so that we can experience the story, you know, from a different perspective.
I know that the author said that one of his, that the inspiration is, I think, from book one, where it describes a line of confused Hufflepuffs trying to leave the building, or trying to leave the Great Hall. And there's that wonderful moment of them clustered together as they try to get back to the common room, collectively saying, "We are not a threat. Please be our friend." Right. And it's such a puff's way of dealing with the problem. But that makes sense, that there's just this very small thing in the background of Harry Potter where not only do you feel like you personally are a secondary character in somebody else's story, but you're a member of a group that is also a secondary character. You're just sort of a third wheel, all of you. But I'm a self-confessed Hufflepuff.
Self-confessed.
Well, the thing is, I'm cool with it. And when I first started teaching a dedicated Harry Potter class, the Pottermore quiz, the official quiz, was still in beta, so people were self-sorting. And back in those days, if you were Hufflepuff, you were hardcore. Only a really hardcore fan would decide that they were in Hufflepuff. So at that point,
because there was no merch.
Right. There's that. And also they just weren't cool. So there was a big group of Gryffindors and a big group of Slytherins and a fairly large group of Ravenclaws. They're always overrepresented in my classes. And there were six Hufflepuffs. All of them were planning to go into K through six teaching. Every single one. And when they were asked, "Well, why are you a Hufflepuff?" they just said something quiet like, "Well, we just want to be useful and good." And looking at all of them, and of course I'm the teacher, so I got a study. I looked at them and I saw, well, they're a small group. So it would only be fair for me to sit with them. And that should have been my big clue that I was a puff, because only a puff gives a dang about this is the only fair thing to do. And then I got officially sorted, and my first thought is, the rest of my family's in Slytherin except for my aunt, so you know, whatever that says. My first thought was, well, I'm sure that it's wrong to create another email address to take it again. It's like, okay, that's a puff answer. And then, well, at least I should be honest with my students that I sorted into Hufflepuff. Like, oh, dang, that's a Hufflepuff answer. And my third thought was, dang it, I was sorted into Hufflepuff and I'll just be a Hufflepuff. And that's also a Hufflepuff answer, is the stubbornness. And I decided, okay, it's House Badger. It's House Puff. I really belong there.
That reminds me so much of what the character Megan goes through, you know, as being a puff. I'm such a puff. And her mother as well, you know, who can't do the killing curse. And you know, she's such a puff. So
such a great twist of events, and yet so we should have seen it coming, sort of thing.
So yeah, just for some like context for folks that have made it in this far, it is available on Amazon Prime for $13 for HD. You can rent it for $4. And when we're talking about the puffs, the thing I think is worth noting is that this is not a licensed Harry Potter product.
Right.
So they had to dance around all of the trademarked terminology in the play. So it's the smarts, the braves, the people who Snakes. Look like they'll throw white wine in your face. and the puffs. So the snakes, but they blonde, blue-eyed, rich, right? So they do make fun of it, and they also find really creative ways around it. So again, smarts, braves, snakes, puffs. So
I'm wearing the sweatshirt now.
Yeah. Nice.
So we're not just being insiders. Oh, the Puffs. No, that's literally why it's called that. And if you look for Puffs on Amazon, make sure you type in Puffs the play. Otherwise, you're going to get a lot of ads for tissues.
Right. Yeah, that is true. I experienced that today. I did.
I got snacks. I got a lot of snacks. Amazon knows
me. Oh, I got some videos of some people smoking some weed also, which is funny. I mean, and I just want to make the point that a lot of what they do, because I think all of us maybe and many of our listeners have dealt with some of the frustration of having to dance around copyright issues with how somewhat aggressive Warner Brothers has been with protecting their copyright in recent years, protecting their intellectual product. And so but I have to say that was one of the funniest things that struck me about Puffs when I was first watching it, is that so much of the humor is actually derived from, or I should say, so much humor is derived from the ways in which the ridiculous ways and yet so cute and so clever ways that they had that successfully avoided those copyright issues.
One of the things I would really like to do as an experiment is have someone who is not a Harry Potter fan watch this. Because I do not know whether it would be funny if you were not part of the in crowd, because part of this play that's so good is that you get that, I'm an insider feeling, that humans love that feeling. Humans love to feel like they're part of the in group. And I happen to be part of two in groups when I watch this, because I came of age at the same time that the characters in the book came of age. So my timeline, the Transformers t-shirts and the Game Boy, blowing on the Game Boy cartridge, and like all the references that they make were a double in crowd reference for me. So I just felt so good because I got it. I understood every joke, you know? And so I would love for like someone who's not a millennial and someone who's not a Harry Potter fan to watch this and see if they think it's good at all.
Well, I'm very definitely not a millennial, so
but you were a big Harry Potter fan.
All of that stuff whizzed over my head, but I certainly got the concept. And I think what I also got was that in the Harry Potter universe, the extent to which the pop culture world and everything like it is kept very, very firmly to the side. It's one of the things, one of the marks of bad fanfic, that Hermione will be listening to sort of emo music on an iPod mysteriously in this castle that is not able to use technology. And so that was something that really, really struck me, is that Wayne is so, so fond of pop culture, and he's bringing it into an environment where nobody apparently knows anything about it. But the result is he comes across as more human.
He's a fan of fantasy literature. He introduces himself as, I've
read the Silmarillion twice. Which, I mean, I would imagine even some Harry Potter fans would not get what he means by that. Like, what?
And like, I can't explain to you the like validation of my sense of self that I felt when they were using the AIM scene. So AOL Instant Messenger was my whole adolescence. And so when they're like, this is a more efficient way to communicate, bling, oh my gosh, the validation. I was like, okay, so not only are you saying something I completely agree with, but that noise is like a positive trigger in my brain. I'm remembering being that age. Man, they do a great job with the in-group. That was like my biggest takeaway from this, was that they rock that in-group.
Yeah. And you know what? I really like the way that they don't even have to do much. And you absolutely know which professor is Snape and that this is supposed to be McGonagall. And then, you know, that's the fat friar, and you know, that they're able to do the characterizations. And I thought it was really interesting that the characterizations, a lot of them, like the guy who's doing Snape, he's really doing Alan Rickman. Right, the way that he talks is sort of
so funny.
Alan Rickman, sort of a funny impression.
One thing that struck me that's part of that is Snape giving the sex education class.
Oh my gosh, that's so hilarious.
Oh my gosh.
Aside from the fact that it is hilarious in itself. It's also really underlines all of the stuff that's never taught at Hogwarts.
Yes.
Like anything, yes. Really like anything. And the other character that really underlines this is Oliver. And I was giving some thought to this as I cleaned the garage today, that Oliver, in a way, sort of comments on Hermione, because yeah. Hermione is the one who's really a good student outside of Hogwarts. And it makes sense that she would be good at studying, but it doesn't necessarily make sense that she would be so fabulous at the magic part of it. And that Oliver comes in and he's used to being tops in everything, just like Hermione. But then he finds himself as the class dunce. And that, I thought, was really interesting. And again, it really underlined the difference between the Hogwarts curriculum, where apparently, whatever, we don't know what arithmancy is, but it doesn't seem like they're studying. They certainly aren't studying composition. And they're certainly not studying any form of mathematics that we, or science that we would recognize. And except for the idea that it's some sort of parallel wizardy version of what you'd normally get, it's really striking how there's no wizard education in the stuff that you'd need to know, except for driver's ed. It's like the one thing.
Yeah, Snape teaching sex ed, and
so it's Snape teaching sex ed is just like, yeah. And the sexuality, too, is that in some ways more realistic. There's all the, quote, snogging in book six, but it's really, really clean. And there's a lot of characters who don't seem to be involved at all. Whereas in Puffs, they're acting a lot more like teenagers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they need sex ed. I mean, which they should get.
Yeah. And the sort of the frustration that there's no math class. You know, where's math? Don't we have to learn math?
Yes.
And I was thinking about this, you know, this version is, it addresses some of the things that people get annoyed with in the series, like, you know, why aren't they learning these other things? What are some of the other things that this version is kind of addressing in the way of a critique?
Well, I mean, Melissa already brought one of them up with the recognition of popular culture, right? That's
right.
Much more there that those raised by muggles or mugborns, as they're called in the show, that they wouldn't just give up their birth culture just because they've entered this new culture, that they would be much more code switchy, that they'd be able to do both. I think the other thing that they poke fun at is, I think this is part of the reason why it was such a hit at Swapaka, is that so many people have been persuaded, I think rightly, by Dr. Chris Bell's argument that Harry's one of the villains of the story.
Oh.
That Harry's kind of a jerk in the story. And I think that this show really lays that bare in a way that Cursed Child tried to do and didn't do.
But I think, though, the idea of Harry as jerk really, because I was thinking about this too, Harry is really a special little princeling. In the production, there's Harry, who's played by a rather attractive young woman with the sort of extra wide eyes. The glasses are really extra wide, and so it sort of makes her look super attractive. And she's also sort of, it's clear that he is Dumbledore's favorite. The favoritism is off the charts. And Hermione and Ron are literally props. I mean, that's what they are.
A broomstick with a wig or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's like a candelabra with a mop head and then a whole mop.
Exactly. And that really, and of course the thing is that that's, I don't think that's really what the text is like.
Yeah, maybe wrong a little bit.
But there's a certain truth to it. And also, this has to do with what happens when you're looking at a text that is, not only is it a novel, so you're going to get the limitation of perspective. One of the reasons I like drama is that you inevitably see things from multiple perspectives at a time. It's one of the reasons I like it. It's one of the reasons my students, frankly, get kind of confused by it. So they'll sort of, one of my pet peeves is people will say, Shakespeare says, to thine own self be true. And I'll say, but no, it's not Shakespeare. It's Polonius, and he's a liar. I mean, that's the end of a long speech in which he says, okay, here, pretend to be this, engage in all this pretense. Oh, by the way, and be yourself. And so you're always seeing this broad perspective. In Harry Potter, it's so not only got that novelistic issue, but it's tight third. So you, in some ways, it's very good from a mystery novel point of view because you just see that little perspective. That, I think, Puffs takes that apart a little bit. It exposes the sort of egoistic point of Harry Potter, where it does really become all about him. And the question of being the chosen one, sort of brings up the, what is it to be the unchosen one? Harry keeps saying over and over, oh, I don't want to be a hero. And Wayne would very much like to be a hero.
Yeah, when he looks in the mirror of Erised, he sees basically Harry's story, except with a lightsaber as well. But he sees, like, I'm going to save all the wizards, and I'll be the hero, you know? And so he would like to be
and
that.
And I'll be with Ginny.
Yes, and with Jenny, right. In some ways, he's more clear-minded about that as a particular ambition. And I think that's interesting. He is in the trio, like he's in the Harry role. And so if we're looking at in the trio, he should be that. But actually, I think what was the early tagline that the play was for anyone who has never been destined to save the world? So the idea is that Wayne is not destined to save the world. He doesn't have the destiny that Harry has and sort of shrugs off, but it does make Harry, it puts him in this privileged position. And Wayne just never has that. He's always kind of on the sideline.
And I think that that kind of drives home the message of the whole play, though. Again, that Cursedchild just so fails to do is that you don't have to save the world to make a humongous impact on other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like such a beautiful, I mean, the message of this play is so good because it shows that you don't have to, you know, it's a life well lived. You know, if you live a good life and you do right by other people and you work hard and you be a good puff, you know, you could be the hero in your own story. And I think it's a really realistic message.
It is, although there's that sort of bitter undertone to his conversation with Dumbledore.
Welcome to being a millennial, bro.
Things like him saying, well, do I get to go back and really be alive? And Dumbledore tells him, well, no, you don't, because you're not Harry. And then he says, now, if you'll please excuse me, I have to meet with Harry now. So Wayne gets brushed off. And so the question is, well, why did I do this? Who's going to remember me? And he is remembered because Megan and Oliver named their kid Wayne. Mm-hmm. And that's the point where we find out that the entire thing has been really narrated from the point of view of Wayne, new Wayne, who has been sorted into Puffs. And is giving us the whole story, not as from his perspective either. He's the narrator. And mm-hmm. I think that's really lovely. Ultimately, Wayne does become important, but not in a way that he expected to, certainly not in a way that he could have planned or appreciated during his own lifetime.
So one thing I remember from having watched the play is not necessarily the details of the plot, but rather just the impression afterwards that Hufflepuffs really are so cool and so much fun and really worthy of praise and admiration. Mm-hmm. So how does the play achieve that with while still also portraying them as often very ridiculous? And what does the play say to us about sorting in general?
I gotta reference Leanne here. Because when we first, Leanne's such a wonderful character. When we first meet her, she's really kind of annoying. And she has that wonderful moment of, we're all wizards, which actually really ought to be kind of cool.
Yes.
But is somehow, somehow not, is not emphasized enough.
It's two steps
in
behind.
Series. And, among other things, she gets to be Helga Hufflepuff in person.
Right.
When
the same actress playing both roles.
So it's another note for the listener who may have not seen this. It's a very Monty Python-ish kind of situation where the characters will change, the actors will change character in the middle of the scene by just adding one like prop to themselves. So it's like an ensemble cast where they're all, except for the three main characters, playing multiple roles.
And that's actually a very old theatrical thing. The concept of one person playing only one role is really more of a modern thing, and actually more of something you see in schools. But it would have been normal to play lots of different roles. Why would you waste an actor who is going to die in Act 3? But the other thing is that when you have a person doubling a role, it can either be just, oh, we need somebody to play that role, or it can be really integrated into the rest of the character. And so Leanne, or the actress playing Leanne, also playing Helga Hufflepuff and being part of this whole backstory on Hufflepuff and what it means to be a Puff is really significant. And also that Leanne morphs from being this kid who is constantly wanting to socialize and bringing everybody together. And I know I was profoundly irritated by people like that. And then at the end, she's really, if you'll excuse me, badass. I mean, she's dueling with two wands at the same time. I think that's really important that you get to go on this journey, yes, with Wayne, but you also get to go with this journey of Leanne, somebody who thinks it's very cool to be a Puff to begin with. The other thing I wanted to be sure to mention was that seeing things from the Hufflepuff point of view really brings different light to things. The idea that becoming in third place is a big deal for them. And you realize that from Harry's point of view, yay, the Gryffindors get to be first place. And it takes a while to see Puffs that you realize, oh, that means the Hufflepuffs are in fourth, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the idea of, it is perfectly logical to me that in year five, Harry is angry. But Wayne's angry too, and losing Cedric is an entirely different scale for the Puffs. He's been the one cool dude, and he is so clearly the one cool dude, and also beloved and friendly, and promises to help Wayne become an awesome wizard and teach him all of these things. So when Cedric goes off and dies, it devastates the house. And so I think that perspective too, seeing it from another angle is, I think, really, really useful. When you go back to read the books, you can't not see it anymore.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking also about how in The Cursed Child, there's also that emphasis on Cedric's death.
it was hard for me to tell. Did Cursed Child come out before Puffs? It seemed like based on some of the references they make in it, that yes, that it did, that Cursed Child did come out.
Yeah, and I looked it up, and Puffs actually came out a year before The Cursed Child, but I think it was filmed after The Cursed Child had been there, so they had probably added in some things that were references to The Cursed
Child. The last
line. And the fact that they cast Cedric as like a genuinely wonderfully pure person is like, it's so tempting to retcon, to see this as like a retcon, to retcon and be like, oh yeah, Puffs, they're redeeming Cursed Child. They might have been, because the actor, like Melissa said at the beginning, it's a skeleton until the actors put their art on it. And so the fact that he's like such a genuinely wonderful person in his house after they bastardized his character in Cursed Child. I have a lot to say about Cursed Child. You know, I loved that he was so wonderful and that they let the house mourn him.
Yeah, and I don't have much of an quote issue with Cursed Child. Mostly I go along for the ride. And I don't feel impelled to see things from the author's point of view. I'm willing to say, yeah, it's canon, but I don't have to like it. And Cedric was one of the ones, there were several caveats that I had where I just couldn't get on board with it. One was the idea of Voldemort having a kid,
yes.
Which at the very least makes me hope that there's some kind of wizard equivalent of artificial insemination, because it's just so gross. But the main thing was Cedric. I absolutely cannot envision Cedric being a Death Eater, especially not because he was, quote, humiliated. Mm-hmm. That's so unlike the character. Yeah. And it also, one of the things that used to be in Pottermore, Rowling said that she initially intended to have Harry visit all four common rooms, and then she couldn't come up with a good excuse to have him go into Hufflepuff. And so that became a thing.
But it's next to the kitchens.
Right.
I know. It's like, what more do you need?
That's the best thing
right
about
there.
It.
But the thing is, if you get sorted into Hufflepuff, you get to see the Hufflepuff common room. And one of the things that's very nice is that it's very hobbity. You know, everything's below ground and it's warm as everything's coppery. There's lots of plants around. The fact that their bedrooms are underground means that they are in some ways least affected by the weather outside, which is badgery, right? Mm. But also one of the things that Gabriel Truman, who is the fifth year prefect, says is that there's fewer dark wizards that come from Hufflepuff than any other house. Mm-hmm. So to have Cedric become a Death Eater really kind of contradicts some of the, not canon, but paracanon or deuterocanonical works that was already there. Mm-hmm. The idea that Hufflepuffs just don't go dark. And this is something, I know we didn't bring up Newt Scamander, but one of the questions we had was whether or not Puffs made Hufflepuffs cool. I don't know if that's quite true. I think they started to become cool with Fantastic Beasts, or more generally cool. And I loved Newt as sort of a different viewpoint. Puffs are really into botany and biology of all kinds. That's their thing. With the exception of Hagrid, the previous Care of Magical Creatures instructor was Sylvanus Kettleburn, and he's also a Hufflepuff. So the thing that Dumbledore says in Crimes of Grindelwald, which I know people might not like, but one of the things he says to Newt is, one of the reasons I respect you is that you do the right thing and you're not interested in heroism. You just do, or you're not about ego. You just do the right thing because the right thing is the right thing to do, including things like standing up for people / animals that don't have a voice. It's very Alan Rabinowitz, who is the founder of Panthera. He said that he was a stutterer and he couldn't speak in front of people at all. So he would go into the closet and talk to his stuffed animals, and he promised them that when he grew up, he would speak for them. And so that's what he did. He grew up and he became a spokesman for big cats, dear Alan Rabinowitz. But that is something that Newt becomes the voice for the voiceless. And that's why I really can't get with this idea that a Hufflepuff and Cedric, who is so very much an epitome of puffness, even in the bad qualities, it's just really hard for me to envision him as becoming a Death Eater. It's just, whereas Puffs, I think, maybe it's because I'm a Hufflepuff, but I think that just knowing the series and just looking at it, it just doesn't really seem, it doesn't really seem to fit with the rest of the series.
I agree. And I think in a way, so when I finished the, watching the play Puffs, I thought this is a play that understands the Harry Potter series, the world, yes, the logic of it, and it actually shares the themes of Harry Potter. And I really didn't get that with The Cursed Child. I thought it sort of doesn't understand the logic of the series. I thought they were both interesting thought experiments that help, that allow you to go back through all of the years, but that Puffs actually, I think, does a better job of really hitting the key notes, right? The value of love and friendship and bravery and just doing what you can for other people. And I think it just does a much better job of that than I think the Cursed Child.
So much better.
They managed to create the atmosphere very inexpensively and have it surround you in a live production. And they managed to do something as simple as when Dumbledore announces that I think a change of decoration is in order, he just puts on a different colored birthday hat. and it's, yeah, the one classic is nested inside the other, and you don't need the other stuff, particularly mm-hmm. if you know the source text. So the minimal qualities of Puffs is, in some ways, it gives it a chance to do its magic.
Mm-hmm.
It right. gives it a chance for theater to mm-hmm. do its particular kind of magic. And right. for you too, because as an audience member, you kind of need to have buy-in. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite plays, I hate to have favorites, but in Shakespeare, Henry V, the line is, "Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts," that you have to be the person who brings in the horses, who makes you see two mighty monarchies. You as an audience member are co-creators.
Right.
And Puffs invites you to do that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Cursed Child, not again that I hate it, but when you see it, it's much more being a consumer. Even mm-hmm. going to purchase merch is like being a...
The merch stand does a costume change at mid-play. So, yes.
The thing is, Puffs has merch,
what
too.
What more is there to say?
Puffs has merch, too, and I'm wearing some mm-hmm. of it, and it's very awesome. It's got the Braves and the Smarts and the Snakes and the Puffs on it, and it's wonderful. But the ever-present sense of merchness, that you're going for an experience, but it is somewhat of a passive experience, whereas Puffs in the theater really is a much more active thing. It surrounds you and you're encouraged, not in the sense of audience participation,
like Rocky Horror.
It's not that level, but it's still, you are very much part of it. It has a few things and it makes maximal use of them.
Yeah.
And Puffs really does do that.
Right.
It doesn't need redecoration. The birthday party hat will do it. And yeah, also the fact that, you know, Hermione as Mop maybe carries it too far, but it invites you to ask that question. On the one hand, you don't waste an actress on Hermione just in the background, but it also makes you ask the question, hey, is Hermione really more than that in Harry Potter? So you take that outside. And another really good thing that theater should do, in my opinion, is it should give you a chance to talk about it later.
Mm-hmm.
You walk out, you want to have a conversation about what you saw and what you didn't see. I can give it some genuine praise just as somebody who has his background in theater and as a director. And Puffs is something that I don't want to say I wish I'd written it or I wish I'd directed it, but in a way I sort of do. It's something I think you can really be proud of.
Yeah.
Not sure about Cursed Child.
I think our listeners have some serious opinions about Cursed Child and Puffs and which one they prefer. And we would love to hear your opinions about whether you're a Cursed Child sort of theater goer as a Harry Potter fan, or if you're a Puffs sort of theater goer. So please do drop us a line and let us know.
If anyone is interested on the discussions about Harry Potter canon that we have spent many, many years having at the Southwest Popular Culture and American Culture Association out at Albuquerque, New Mexico, or at the Harry Potter Academic Conference in Philadelphia at Chestnut Hill College. I did make a video sort of synthesizing the conversation that we have had over the years. We argue that Harry Potter canon is not an in tray and an out tray. It is a filing cabinet. You just got to figure out what drawer it goes in, because everything should fit, because that's the nature of this fandom. It's been built to take it all in and be something for everybody. So, you know, it's obviously become a little more complicated in the last year with problematic statements from the author.
Lordy.
But and the just obvious commercialization. I mean, like, so Melissa, I know you said there's merch at Puffs, and of course there is. This is a small theater company that needed to pay for the theater. You know, I felt dirty after I bought the lots and lots of merch that I bought at Cursed Child, but I could not buy it. I needed it.
Well, the thing is,
and that was before she said her shit, I'm never giving her my money again. But
and the thing is, two things, again, as a theater person. First of all, my book is all about making money in theater. You have to make money, otherwise you're out of business. And there's nothing shameful about money in and of itself. But the other thing that's really cool about theater, at least during Shakespeare's time, it was the theater company that owned the play, not the author. The author, Shakespeare is different in that he was a member of the theater company. But when you see plays, they'd often just have, as it hath been publicly acted by the king's men. And it isn't until a little bit later in the Rebels accounts that you start to see that little note by Shaq's bird. So at least with theater, it's perfectly legit to say, why are we getting all hung up on the author thing? It's just not important. So I'm able to kind of put it to one side. I still think it's an ethical issue, but from my point of view, the author's just, you know, just part of the overall thing. You don't need to put the author on a pedestal. And if the author insists of jumping off the pedestal into the dumpster, well, that's just very sad.
So I'm just going to reiterate Emily's call. If our listeners want to weigh in on, you know, some of these issues about the, you know, comparison between these two plays, or your experiences of them, or you know, your thoughts on you know, some of the ways that we can understand the growth of the, you know, the fan productions that are coming out of the Harry Potter world, please drop us a line because we might use your, you know, your comment as a part of our show. And that brings us now to our segment that we call Owl Post.
Look up. It's time for Owl Post.
The letter today comes from listener Lee Kinvey, who is responding to episode 4, which was on violence and civilization. We talked in that episode with Dr. Aurélie Lacassagne, and she provided some good food for thought on what kinds of violence society tends to recognize or civilizations recognize. And we had all talked in that show about the kinds of violence in the Harry Potter series that bothered us the most. This is Lee Kinvey's response.
Greetings, professors. I am Lee Kinvey, and I am leaving a comment about your January 11th episode on violence and civilization. Totally loved it. Thank you so much. My comments center around how it seems like violence that's physical in nature, that we as muggles can imagine happening in our world, is what we think of as violence. I heard that throughout your podcast episode, the slap punch, the snake eating the person, the nose crunching under a foot, these we can sort of understand and imagine. I mean, Fred and Harry get perhaps more severely punished for their muggle dueling than for their wand work that they do to each other, right? And of course, most of the violence in the series is conducted through wands and curses. And maybe that feels somehow less violent to us. If a slap is more civilized than a punch, then is a wand flick that gives the same feeling or causes the same amount of pain even more civilized because, what, skin isn't meeting skin? And isn't it true that the more civilized our violence, the more removed we are from it, and the less likely we are to feel it and to integrate it and therefore sort of subject it to our moral compasses? And it seems like we see that in the wizarding world too. Historians talk about how it was quite a shift in war making between when people had to do hand-to-hand combat and had to look at the people they were injuring. And even when they had to see, you know, the whites of their eyes and shoot them up close, is quite a different moral dilemma for a soldier than dropping a bomb on a city. So those are my comments, and I'm totally curious to hear what you have to say about it. Thanks so much for the work you do. I love this. Bye-bye.
Great thoughts, Lee. Thank you for that response to the episode. It was a very thought-provoking episode. I hope our listeners have had a chance to listen to that one. And I really agree. I find myself gravitating towards Harry Potter because it feels less violent maybe than other franchises, but I think Lee's really pointing out astutely that that could be more of an illusion or just an impression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. That's an excellent point. All right, that brings us to the end of our episode today. Thanks so much to Dr. Lauren Camacci and Dr. Melissa Aaron for being on the show with us. Thank you
and
both.
Go see Puffs. Please go see Puffs. Yeah. It will be a good time. You'll love it.
And yeah. I'm going to go skipping away from my computer going, Jay Finch, finching around.
I know. It's so quotable. That's another reason to watch it with friends, you know?
It's really true.
We are going to end this episode with the wisdom of the Sorting Hat, who tells us about the founding of Hogwarts. Said Slytherin will teach just those whose ancestry's purest. Said Ravenclaw will teach those whose intelligence is surest. Said Gryffindor will teach all those with brave deeds to their name. Said Hufflepuff, I'll teach the lot and treat them just the same.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburnd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburnd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.